All right, folks.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I've never seen a night so long. When time goes crawling by, the moon just went behind the clouds to hide its face and cry.
Many of you may wonder why I'm playing that song. Yes, you know that is Hank Williams. Well, today I am very blessed to have Rick Bragg with me here today. And Rick, maybe you could tell us why that song has significance.
Well, he was my people's poet. And my mother used to sing that song in the kitchen when she was cooking and making biscuits or pinto beans and ham. He was our poet. I think I wrote once that he kind of spread the pain of the mill workers and steel workers and cotton farmers out thin enough to where they could stand it. You know, he'd sing their pain back to them, but he would thin it out a little. And he was pretty well worshipped by my people.
Absolutely. And of course, we're talking about All Over But the Shoutin' by Rick Bragg. And of course, he is a well-known author, has written so many different books that I could sit here and name, but we'll be talking about some of them. He also writes a column for Southern Living. That's right. So you may have seen some of his articles in Southern Living. But I was particularly impressed about the part in the prologue of your book when you were talking about your grandmother and how you came back to see your grandmother and you started thinking about all the things and sleeping at the end of the bed of your grandmother and the radio on and this song came on and so many others.
And it would, you know, she had the only room that had a window that faced, you know, northerly. So we fooled ourselves in believing that that wind would be cooler. And I would lay there with my head half in and out of the windowsill. You know, the bed had like four mattresses on it, so it was like, you know, 5 feet high. And Hank would come on the radio and he would sing things that would make that old woman cry. I'll never forget, you know. And it'd make her remember, too. And Hank Williams, Jimmy Rogers before him.
Farron Young.
Farron Young, oh gosh, yeah.
Little Jimmy Dickens.
Little Jimmy Dickens. I can still do a very poor Farron Young impersonation, but I don't think I can afford the royalty, so we won't do that.
Go ahead, because I'll pay him with my licenses. So go ahead if you'd like to do it. Go ahead.
I can't remember if it's Farron Young or Ernest Tubb, but I do a really bad imitation.
Really bad one.
Yeah, especially Walking the Floor Over You. I can massacre that.
You can massacre
well.
That?
Yeah.
Well, I just thought it was so interesting. And I love how your grandmother said, when you're old, the benefits of being old. You can play your radio all damn night long if you want to, and no one can do a damn thing about it.
That's it.
You know, don't you just look forward to those days when you can do those things where...
I might have been doing that since I was 27, but but yeah, I do look. And I'm already getting away with a lot.
Are you?
You know, yeah, I look a lot more decrepit than I am.
Yeah.
So I'm getting away with a good bit.
Well, I just thought this was a great section right here. And one of the things, if you've never read any of his books, if you like having every detail explained to you in detail so that you can actually picture it, I would be interested to know, Rick, how you can remember some of these things, or is this fantasy, or is it really the way it was?
You know, it's as we were talking about a bit before when we were off mic, I wish it was fantasy. I wish it was made up. I wish that, you know, the walking down a railroad track with all your clothes in brown paper bags, fleeing a drunk, were not things that you lived through, but just things you made up, like Faulkner or, you know, Eudora Welty or Flannery O'Connor. But, you know, they're part of living. And the details are easy to remember because they are repeated over and over and over again. If you write about one drunken interlude, you remember it specifically because, you know, drunks don't change much from one really good drunk to another. You know, they either fall in the river or they fall over the railroad track or they fall over the coffee table, but they're always falling over something.
Right.
So it's part of it is remembering succinctly, and part of it is just knowing things. Watching things, seeing things over a young lifetime that don't change very much. Drunks are predictable.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Cruelty is pretty predictable, and humor, Southern humor, is pretty predictable. So, I wish it was made up. God, that really would have made living a dream. We'd have grown up in a suburb with a Volvo and a
picket fence.
Right, and picket fence and a really, 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 really good cable package. But we didn't.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the foothills of the Appalachians in a county called Calhoun near the town of Jacksonville, which at the time was mostly a mill town with a small college, teacher's college. And it's a great place to grow up. It was one of the most beautiful places in the world. You know, in the winter, the mists come down, you know, and cover the tops of the mountains. It's one of the truly beautiful things on this planet. But,
well, that has to be kind of hard then to have the beauty and then have the ugliness, right, the poverty of right. growing up for
well,
you.
Well, you know, the blue collar life and dignity that existed when I was a small child. Mm-hmm. And you had uncles who worked for U.S. Steel, who brought home great blue-collar paychecks. You had uncles who worked in cotton mills and made decent livings. You had...
How about your dad?
My dad drank his paychecks away when he had one. And, you know, I wish it wasn't that way, but that's just a fact. And, you know, he was prone to disappear. He gambled a lot, fought, drank, did what he wanted to do.
And he was a Korean War vet, correct?
He fought in the Korean War, and he was in some ways kind of a bloodthirsty man. He killed a communist soldier by holding his head underwater. So he was doing what I think he thought he had to do. But he enjoyed fighting. He was always a fighter. You know, beer
well,
joints.
Well, he taught you how to fight,
well,
didn't he?
Yeah,
I mean, yeah,
yeah,
he told you what to do to fight, right?
Well, all of his boys would have been bitter disappointments if we had not wanted to fight.
Mm-hmm.
My big brother Sam beat me up on a fairly routine basis. My mother, when my father disappeared the last time for good, my mother did everything she could do to, you know, she'd only gone to the sixth grade in school, so she worked as a maid. She cooked for other families. She tended other people's babies. She took in laundry, and she picked cotton and filled that gap.
Knowing that, I mean, we are talking about All Over But the Shoutin', which is a book about your growing up and about your mom. Your mom has read that book, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What does your mom think of the book?
Oh, she told me once, she said... you know, I lived through that. Reading about it in a book, of course, wasn't going to bother me. And
that's very interesting.
Yeah. And
did she ever tell you you shouldn't have written that?
No, she did. No, she never said I shouldn't have written it. She didn't understand how it was important. She didn't at first. She didn't understand how it was important. But then, when the first 10,000 or so people reach out to her by snail mail and say, or call her, mm-hmm. you know, find her phone number and call her. And when the first 10,000 or 20,000 and go on from there, tell her what the book meant to them, then maybe it was important. And she would never believe me in telling her that it was important. But she understood in time that it meant a lot. She told me she cried once after, not until many years later that you know, she cried when she read it. But she...
It's hard to believe. You know, I would imagine for her, looking back on that, to have said, oh, my God, I didn't realize the effect or how it was perceived by you.
Well, you know, everybody in her world, not every family, but everyone close around her was standing in line for commodity cheese and peanut butter. Mm-hmm. Everybody in her world had a baby on their hip at the city jail or the county jail or at the state prison or at the federal stockade. Everybody had, and Daddy was in all of those. And everybody had a man who drank too much and lost his finer nature. Mm-hmm. So everybody suffered and everybody. Now, you know, it was odd when I would see an intact family. You know, I'd see an intact family and you know, often, you know, they'd be like church going people, pious people. And you know, my mother was devout, but, you know, we were not. You know, we were heathens. And so I don't think she, to this day, I don't think she understands. You know, I've showed her that the book is, you know, published in, you know, Belgium or in China. But, you know, I can show her, you know, that it's, you know, knocking on a million copies sold in this country, or I can do all that. But it just doesn't. She just doesn't, I don't think, will ever really understand that it kind of became an anthem for people. So that whenever someone says that to her or says something touching to her, she always brings it to my attention as though I didn't know. And that...
Well, that's being a mama, yeah, right?
Did you know? And I said, yes, Mama, the book's been out 20 years. I was aware of this fact. But you know, she's a mom.
Right.
I'm her child, and I'm her boy, and I'm her middle boy. So I am obviously not very intelligent and cannot be trusted with sharp objects or history.
Well, I like what you wrote in the book talking about your mom. My mama believes that she failed, that her three sons, being all she has ever had, did not get enough of the fine things in life because she was our mother. My older brother Sam worked like a dog his whole life in the coal yard and clay pits when he was 11 with a pick and shovel and a yard rake when he was a young man, and now in the cotton mill. He has never had a full day of rest in his life. I cannot remember when. She blames herself for that. And then she talks about your younger brother being in and out of jails. And then there was another child that died mm-hmm. before he was even named.
Mm-hmm. She really thinks that there might have been something that she could have done to avoid that. But I don't know what it would have been.
Don't you think all mamas think that, though?
I think so. And I think she I think she just feels like that there should have been some miracle that she might could have somehow performed. But, you know, she did. She did perform one. You know, we are all alive. You know, the little brother that I lost was, you know, lost it not long after birth. So I don't think there was, you know, she could have, that child could have lived if she'd had good health care. Mm-hmm. It could have lived if she'd had some luck, but she didn't. And so I don't know. Very few things in life are you really sure of when you get to be knocking toward 60. You're not really sure of a lot. I used to think that things would become clear to me, you know, that I would have some kind of wisdom. But all right. I am is more confused. But the one thing I'm not confused about is that I had a good one. You know, I had a good mama. And I had a mama who sacrificed and waited to eat so that her boys would have the best of what was there until we were able, old enough to know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have no doubt that she's the best mama in the world.
Well, I think I think that she probably, as she's going through this, and that's why I wondered, you have since then, you have bought her, this is her second home that she's in now, right?
Yeah, she better like this one because she's not, she is not getting another one. The first house I bought her was, we wrote about it all over Beth Shout, and it was a 4-bedroom brick house on a hill. You'd think that'd be an adequate house for
right.
an old woman, you know? Living alone,
right.
You know, you'd think that would be, you know, central heat and air.
Yeah,
you know,
the good stuff.
Yeah, you know, you know.
Stocked with a refrigerator
right,
that was full.
Right,
yeah.
2 acres of beautiful trees, and you'd think that'd be fine. But no, I asked her once, 7 years later, I said, how you liking your house now, Mom, now that you've gotten used to it? And she said, well, hon, it's got too many light bulbs. And she didn't like the house because it had too many light bulbs. So well, first off, I thought, shoot me now, you know. But then I went and found her a red cedar cabin deep in the woods, surrounded by mountain pasture
mm-hmm.
and a tree line and rocks, you know, where the foxes and the hawks and the owls, you know, or just slink through the woods and you know, beautiful pasture, you know, a fish pond, and just the right amount, apparently, of light bulbs in her house.
Because she loves that house.
And it's a red cedar cabin, so she is extremely happy with it. Reminds her some, although it's one of those cabins that, you know, central heat and air and,
right.
you know, all that.
The good stuff,
she's,
yeah.
But she... It reminds her of being a child, and because they lived in true cabins, and it reminds her of home. It reminds her of the way things were before things got complicated. And you know, she loved her daddy, and she loved her mom, and her childhood, even though it was very tough, and certainly there were deprivations, but it was the happiest time of her life was when she was a little girl.
You know. I find this all fascinating, and I particularly like where you talk about you, what's your mother, and raising you, what she would have thought. She said, she gave him, let's just see if we can read this. Then there is me, the newspaper man who threw a leg up that she gave him in a series of happy accidents, wound up at the temple of this profession working under legends. I am no better, no worse than my brothers. In fact, they are both smarter than me. But the truth is that I am proud of who I am, and what I am just as proud of is being the son of a woman who picked cotton, took in ironing, as I am working for a place like the New York Times. I have always believed that one could not have been without the other. I love that sentence right there.
Oh, thank you.
Because we need to remember where we came from in order to accomplish things in life.
There's a paragraph... I think so. And there's a paragraph further on where, you know, I took her with me to New York to pick up an award. And you know, we were on the plane, and she had never been on a plane, ever. And she was amazed at the tiny little salt and pepper shakers, you know.
Isn't it amazing the things that people think of that we take for granted?
Well, she didn't know we were on the plane. She thought on getting on a plane meant that you walked out on the runway on the tarmac, and like in Elvis in Blue Hawaii, you went up a series of steps and someone hung a strand of flowers around your
around neck.
And that ain't the way you get on a plane in the 2000s. In 96, I think it was. You go through the chute.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't ever see the sky. So in her mind, she's just going to another waiting room and was greatly surprised when the waiting room lifted off the the runway and we were going. Then the waiting room was flying at 30,000 feet. And she looked over at me and said, when do we get on the plane? And, you know, there were no propellers. You know, there was, you know, there, you know, Bing Crosby wasn't singing. So there was a line where I was talking about where we had come from and where we were going. And Shouten had already, you know, gotten great attention. Mm-hmm. Just the idea of it was getting great attention. And I added this line later. I said, you know, we had to get on a plane to come that far. And I think that's true in that regard. But she loved the little salt and pepper shakers. She loved, even my mom didn't like airplane food. I mean, she was just not happy with the food. But she was fascinated by the little tiny utensils.
And you wrote in here, when I was a man of 33, they even let me let me into Harvard, and I was not holding a mop.
Nah.
Yeah.
Nah.
And when I was 36, I won the highest award our profession bestows. I hope she blames herself for that, too.
She thinks that's all a series of, like, happy accidents. She really doesn't get that, you know, the fact she went 18 years without a new dress so that I could have school clothes is a direct link to that, is cause and effect. She just doesn't believe it. Honest to God, believes she doesn't get it. And it doesn't have anything to do with her intelligence. It has to do with her experiences. And
well, if you've always been in the same place, how do you realize there's any difference?
Right. Well, she, you know, I can buy her a house.
Right.
And I can buy her another house.
Right.
And I can do all manner of things to try to make her life easier. But if my brother Sam plows her garden, and if she grows a pot of pepper or a handful of good tomatoes, in her eyes, that really is more important. I know people won't believe that, but that's tangible. She is more proud of my brother Sam than me because he, you know, he stayed in the county. Mm-hmm. He stayed right close by her. He raised a child and stayed married to the same woman for knocking on 50 years now. You know, he's solid. I don't even have a real job. I don't even do real work. I don't get dirty when I work. I don't have a real job. I guess I cut out paper dolls for a living. That's the way they make it sound. If I say to them, people in my family, I say, I can't go with y'all because I have to stay home and work. They actually snort and chortle. You know, what do you mean work? You don't do nothing. Well, you know, I write books. You know, I do magazine pieces. I once, when I was a journalist, a newspaper journalist, I did some even little slightly dangerous work and covered bad things. But they don't see that. They probably saw that more as real work,
right,
than the books. The books are like,
that's fantasy.
Yeah,
they just knock those out.
Yeah, you just knock them out, you know. They don't count the years it takes to do a good book. Like the most recent one took about 3. That doesn't count because it's not real work. I'm not swinging a hammer. I am not using a saw.
It's not manly work.
Yeah, yes. I'm not getting dirty. If I were getting dirty, it'd be real work. So every now and then I do something and get real, 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 real dirty just to even things out.
Like what?
I don't know. If the vet comes and has to do some kind of work on the livestock, I'll volunteer to, like, get down in the mud and hold it. You know?
And then they say what?
And then they say, what's wrong with you? Did you fall down? Did you slip down? Did you fall down coming back from the car? But you can't win.
Right.
Because, you know, you tell them, you convince them, finally convince them how hard you work to get a book out.
Right.
And and they finally get to believe in you a little bit, that how miserably hard it is. And how unglamorous, and that's probably not a word, but
right.
And how much it lacks any real glamour. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, the book makes the bestseller list. Everybody celebrates. Everybody's happy. They're happy in New York. They're happy in Alabama.
Right.
But you know, it may win
the
an
process.
Award. Yeah,
the
it
process.
May it may win an award. But you know, it is, you convince them how hard it is to do that. And then you do your book tour. And you're sitting around, you got your bag packed, and it's sitting in the living room, and up pulls a black limousine. Because they got to take you to the airport because you can't drive yourself because your car would sit there for 3.5 months. Because you're going to be gone. You know, flying every day and going from hotel to hotel. All they see is the black limousine. And when you say, I got to go back on book tour, God, I dread that, they laugh out loud and snort and chortle. So you cannot win. You cannot win. So I give up. I give up. I have no real job.
You have no real job.
I just play in the fields of the Lord.
You know, it's great work if you can get it, right?
I reckon.
Yeah, I reckon. But I'll bet. Does something ever, you struggle with stuff to write something? Do the words just jump off? You know, like when I'm doing a commercial, you know, my best commercials are when I just come in and go, okay, I'm done. Let's record it, right? But when I have to struggle with a commercial, it seems to take me forever. How do you write?
It's static, right? Sound static, because it comes in static.
Right.
Pieces. The phrases, the sayings, the imagery and the color and the detail, at this point in my life, do come easy. But the organization is still brutally hard. You know, how does this paragraph fit in this chapter? How does this chapter fit in the overall scheme of the book? Is it clear? Is it thoughtful? Or is it just pretty? You know, I can make it pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, is it clear? Is it thoughtful? Is the message strong or is it veiled by too much Gothic language? So, yeah, it's still hard work. But I do admit that the imagery, the color, writing about a field, writing about an old pasture, writing about poke salad plants and you know, growing against the weathered, you know, cedar posts of an abandoned pasture fence. Those things are such a part of my life and such a part of my childhood that they just pour out. But making it all fit into the apparatus. And, you know, you'd think that that would not happen, that it would just all flow.
Right.
I don't know a writer on earth who says that organization is not their hobgoblin. And it has certainly always been mine. It's my hobgoblin. That and time. I never have enough time.
Never have enough time. I am here with Rick Bragg. We are talking about All Over But the Shoutin'. It is the Greenwood Reads this time, and we are having a great conversation. I hope you will stay right with us right now. We are going to hear a quick word from our sponsors. We'll be right back. Don't you go away. The antique vintager has arrived in Greenwood. He's been in Greenwood, but he's been incognito. Now unveiled for the very first time, the antique vintager, the one and only Jeff Eller, is debuting on the national stage with his podcast. Shouldn't you be one of the first to come in and see him and see what you have with What's It Worth? Can you sell it? Do you want to sell it? And should you sell it? Only the antique vintager can tell you such things. So come and see us at 637 Durst Avenue East. Call first for your appointment. 864-229-6613. The antique vintager, Jeff Eller, is in the building. Oh, that's right. We're right back here on WCRS 98.5 and, of course, 1450 AM, 77 years on the air. And we have a young guy with us. You're not even close to 70. Yes, that's
right. I just
right.
feel 70.
Okay, just because those teenagers have wore you out today, right? Yeah. Where have you been today? Goodness, you've been to what? Greenwood High?
Emerald?
And
96.
So how was that experience for you, Rick Bragg? We're talking about All Over But the Shoutin'. It is Greenwood Reed's great selection. Prudence, I am so impressed with this one. This one was great. Okay.
They worked me like a galley slave.
They worked you like a galley
yeah,
slave?
They chained me to the oars and and set me to rowing. And I'm scared of kids. Today was mostly, now there were some people from the community, quite a few as a matter of fact at the last one, but you know, mostly today was for the students. Mm-hmm. And they asked great questions. They were thoughtful. They had read the book or had certainly read up. Many of them had just finished the book, but they were startling in the depth and the breadth and the just the way they kind of saw it. A lot of them had lived the life that I wrote about. A lot of them saw their own mothers and fathers. A lot of them were raised in single-family homes. A lot of them knew that story already before we, anyone assigned it.
That's kind of scary, isn't it?
It is scary, and so it's kind of like wishing that it was fiction.
Yeah.
And wishing that theirs was, too. But instead, you just know that it's just a much bigger family, you know, than you ever would have first thought. But they were great. But there's a lot of them, and they kept me moving. They just kept me moving. And when I'd be finished with one group, they'd chain me to another galley and send me off in another direction. And so I've learned not to trust these people. They'll get you up here and... They'll get
you
up here.
Work you like a dog.
Work you like a dog. So I'll know better next time. But and tomorrow we go to, where are we going?
Wear Shoals. At 10 o'clock, and the public's invited, yes?
The public is invited to the one at 10 o'clock.
The one at 10 o'clock, right. That's right.
But we have students from like 4 in the morning on.
So. 4 in the morning? I don't think we get our kids up that early, do we?
No, I think they're camping out there. But they're waking me up at the crack of dawn. I don't do mornings real good.
When is the best time for you to write?
Oh, late night.
Late night?
When things are quiet and dark, it's the best time to write.
Yeah.
If I get out of South Carolina alive, I will consider that to be a... Because I got a feeling that it's going to be one of those things where when I do finish my last talk,
right. It'll
be like Groundhog Day. It'll start all over again the next day. And they'll just keep on abusing and abusing and abusing my finer nature till finally there's nothing left.
Well, it'll leave you something to write about, Rick.
No, because I'll be dead. I'll be squeezed dry.
Wrung out and hung to dry or something?
Yeah. When a car pulls up in my driveway in Calhoun County, Alabama, this desiccated old husk of a man will just be pushed out onto the carport, and there I'll be.
And you'll say, "That's from Greenwood, South Carolina."
That's right. So I'm just right now. I'm just trying to survive.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we have a song. You know, there was a song. Drink Small, who is a blues singer who's like 90 some now, wrote a song. I'm 75 and trying to survive. That was his song when he was 75, and by now I think he's like 90 some.
Right. Well, I'm 59 and about to die, so I don't know if I'm going to last this or not.
Well, we sure enjoy having you here today. And, you know, there's a couple other things that I wanted to ask you. Number one, you've written many books. Favorite book that you've written?
Oh, that is such a good question because, I think that this answer changes day to day. But All Over But the Shoutin' was the most important because it was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
It remains kind of an anthem for working people.
Right.
And if you scratch most people in the South deep enough, let's face it, most people in the country or the world, you know, they're a whole bunch of Chinese reading it. There's, you know, they're European audiences. But if you scratch most families, you will find working people. Very few people really did come over on the Mayflower. So most people know those people in the book. So I think it is the most important because it became that kind of anthem. But Avis Man, the story of my bootlegger grandfather, who was a giant of a man, was a flawed giant, mm-hmm. was the most fun. Prince of Frogtown, about my own father, to try to kind of make up for the damage to his legacy that I did in Shouting, was the best written, by far the best written of anything I ever did. But in New York, you know, the commercial success of the new book, The Best Cook in the World, mm-hmm. They say it's the best book since Shouting. You hate to say, no, it ain't. You know, since it's the one that's out there right now.
Right, exactly.
But yeah, we went up on the bestseller list for a few weeks, and it's gotten a lot of great attention. But, you know, I've done biographies on other, like I did a biography of the prisoner of war, Jesse Lynch, that, you know, I loved her and really
loved. I was very impressed to see that you'd done a book.
Yeah, and then, you know, we did the most dangerous book, probably, was the Jerry Lee Lewis biography, where, you know, he shot his bass player in the chest with a .357 Magnum, which I think might have been the same one he showed me that he kept under his pillow. And I remember thinking when I got back in the car that if he had shot me, he wouldn't have meant to. And then I thought, what difference would that make? You're just as dead, right?
Exactly.
But I greatly enjoyed spending time with Jerry Lee, and he kind of took me by the hand and kind of led me off down history. A very dangerous, bleak, hilarious history, but, you know, I got to see him make Elvis cry. I got to see him, in New York at the Steve Allen Show getting ready to do whole lot of shaking going on. Mm-hmm. And of course, later, you know, a half century or more later, I got to see him play that song in a nightclub in New York City and, you know, dedicate it to me. That meant something. So, and I came away liking him, the rascal. So, I've been really lucky to get to do this and to get to do serious, I think, and important stories. But the most important were the ones about family. I've never written anything in my life that didn't have some, I don't want to say weight because that sounds pretentious, but there was something at stake mm-hmm. in them. And I've been really lucky. I mean, blind, dumb, stumbling, you know, blind hog finds an acorn every now and then, lucky. And I'm not being facetious. It takes a certain amount of luck.
Absolutely. You have to, you know, yeah. We always say you have to be in the right place at
the right
time.
Right. Yep. And it just takes you may have the story.
Right.
And you may want to do a book and may want to do a great book, but you may not get to do it.
Correct.
So, you know, and I've been lucky. Mostly my books have had the machine and the power of New York publishers behind them. So they reached people, and they reached my people. They wouldn't have reached my people if it had not been for that Yankee machine behind them pushing and taking them into those little towns, taking them into those small-town bookstores.
Do you think it would be any different today with books and everything, with your books that you wrote, you know, years ago now?
I actually think about that often, and the truth is, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It might be easier to get them out, but it may also be that publishers have drawn even the best ones, and you know, Knopf is my publisher now, and they the best that's ever been, mm-hmm. and. But even the best publishers have in some ways drawn in their horns a little bit. And maybe they might not have taken the chance on someone like me.
Right.
But it's impossible to say. I like to think they would. I know that many of the same people that were with me in the beginning are with me now. So, You like to think that it would. I'm fascinated by the culture of books and by the relationship, like for instance between Thomas Wolfe and Max Perkins. You know, the relationship between the great writer and the brilliant editor. I have a great, great editor, a brilliant editor, and she handles my books with some. She will have a real firm hand on the proverbial tiller of where it's going to go. And on others, like the most recent book, she just, no, I like this. Let's just go with this, you know.
And you go, what?
You like it? Yeah. And you never know. And I don't want to sound like a New York guy, God help me, but, you know, my agent is the best literary agent in the country, and she is hard to get a book through. If she doesn't like it, it's not going to be passed on to the, you know, to the editor anyway. So I've got a bunch of sheriffs. You know, I've got a bunch of sheriffs, and I got good sheriffs.
Do you ever find yourself writing like, well, I know she'll like this?
You kind of get to know your people, and you kind of get to, you know, you can't. What you cannot do is second guess them all the way through the process, because it'll paralyze you. But yeah, I mean, every now and then you write a line, and you think, yeah, the Yankees are going to love this.
The South will rise again.
The Yankees are going to think this is very rustic.
Well, that's terrific. You know, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I had two things I wanted to talk about with you. And, you know, I was really fascinated. I mean, there's good stories throughout the book, but the prologue to me in this All Over But the Shouting just sets the stage for everything else that is going on there. And you were talking about when you were writing for a newspaper, you were in New Orleans, and you were writing the story about a little boy that had been killed one morning by a stray bullet as he stood in his doorway. And we can talk a little bit about that, but you write in the book, but this time I had to ask why. Why thank me for scribbling down her hopeless story for the benefit of people who live so far and safely away from this place where the gunfire twinkles like lightning bugs after dark? She answered by pulling out a scrapbook of her baby's death cut from the local newspaper. "People's remembers it," she said. "People's forgets it if it ain't wrote down."
Yeah, that's still the most. You try to write pretty about the ugliest of things, and I don't know anymore because I thought wisdom would come with the getting older, but instead just doubt and confusion.
You get more confused.
You do, and unsure of.
When you're young, you can have. This is the way life is, right? When you get old and you've lived it, you go, I don't know.
No, exactly. But in that case, you know, I wanted to write pretty. You say you want to lend dignity. I once actually spouted this line, said that you best thing you can do as a writer is lend dignity to people's lives that have not always been gotten the dignity that they deserved. Well, you don't lend it. It's already there. It's just all you do is you try to describe it pretty. You try to write it pretty. You don't lend anything to them. You just try to write it pretty. In that case, the sadness, emotion drives the writing. Mm-hmm. Bland, dispassionate, objective thought doesn't drive a damn thing. But that thought of that child, you know, being shot by that stray bullet, just going to school, just standing on the stoop, preschool, I think it was, and having, you know, those children's books tumble out of that little satchel, and, you know, in my mind I could see, like, you know, Dr. Seuss all I wanted
still
to do.
Something you can see, isn't it?
Right. Oh yeah. You see, and you don't forget things like that. You don't forget what the inside of the Murrah Building looked like in Oklahoma City when it was bombed. You don't. Yeah, I'll never forget what the inside of the hospital in Haiti looked like, as the people were just heaved in there and warehoused who'd been shot by the military and put in there without any medicine. There were nurses, but all they could do was pray for them. They didn't have any medicine. So, you remember those things and they stick with you over time. But my job at the time, and I think my job now as a writer, is to write pretty about those ugly things. And you may not make sense of it. You used to think you were making sense of things. Now I'm not sure I ever make any sense about things.
I know what you're talking
about. You know
what
I mean?
Yep, I do.
But
I stand here and talk on the radio, and here I am by myself talking and expounding upon things, wondering if anybody is making any sense out of what
no,
I'm saying.
Well, I really feel that. But the beautiful thing about writing about family or writing about your own culture is maybe I'm a little bit closer to that surety. Maybe I'm a little bit closer to, not conviction, but closer to some kind of understanding or sharing some kind of image or detail or color, which I think is the secret to good writing. It's the seasoning of good writing. But in that seasoning is also an awful lot of good facts. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. I'm, you know, the really bad thing is I am more confused now than I have ever been.
I understand that. And, mm-hmm. and you know, when you're talking about your dad, when your dad calls and wants you to, your mother takes the call and wants you to come over there and see him, and she tells you that it might be the last time that you see him.
I'll never forget the, you know, walking into that room in this little tiny little house in the Mill Village in Jacksonville, Alabama. And, sometimes I suspect that most of our mail goes to Jacksonville, Florida, but but I remember, and we'll never forget walking into that house and seeing my dad. And he was dying of cirrhosis of the liver, but he also had tuberculosis, and he drank himself to death essentially, and you know, the seeing him, you know, bearded and emaciated, and knowing that this is what death looks like. This is what death looks like.
And you were how old then?
I was 13 or 14. I was young. I think I was knocking on being in the 10th grade. I was in the 10th grade at Jacksonville High School.
I was going on 16.
Yeah.
6 feet
yeah.
2 and 185 pounds. Now,
yeah.
You were a big guy.
Yeah, I was a lot slimmer then. actually, not so much. I've slimmed down a lot in my old age. But I will always remember that. Now, I've had years and years and years and years and years and years to try to put that in some place in my mind. It's one of the reasons why I can talk about it. Other things, it's very hard to talk about. But he, you know, in some ways, this was the happiest that it would ever get with Daddy. You know,
he had a present for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, he had me a .22 rifle and a box of books. And, you know, great books, like, you know, Zane Grey paperbacks and stuff like that. And I
thought it was so neat because you said the only thing that was in your mama's house was a seed catalog and the
New Testament.
Yeah. St. James Bible.
Yeah, I think I said King James Bible, and my mama said, son, you know, we are like New Testament folks. So, yeah, I can't get that one back. You know, in some ways, one of the reasons it's easy to talk about that is because it was the happiest things got with him. You know, it's not.
Right.
It was not really, even though I knew he was would not be long with us. I was just a kid, and no one that I had ever really loved had or known mm-hmm. had died. I mean, think
and
about
he
it.
And you kind of had been estranged from your
yeah,
dad.
Yeah, and he
years.
Was such a stranger, so. To see him to think that he cared something about me, you know, after all this time, that he cared something about me was as good as it was ever going to get. Yeah, there's never been a
there
better
day. There was a
day.
Movie called that, As yeah, Good As It
yeah,
Gets.
it was never going to be any better than it was right then.
And you spent the whole afternoon with him. You thought you'd go over there and just get what was
and
get out of there.
And he told me some stories, you know, and he... that I probably put too much value on, too much weight on. But we get to do that. You know, we get to do that with family.
Absolutely. And I thought it was interesting. You talked about there was a water-damaged Faulkner.
Right.
And a paperback with two naked women on the cover.
Yeah, I might have kept that one. I had
and he told you to get rid of it or something.
Before your mama saw it. Yeah, don't let your mama see it. There were actually some great paperbacks in that. But there was, I think, a...
One Hemingway?
Yeah, I think there was a Ray Bradbury book in there. There was definitely...
Arabian Nights?
Yeah, there was some... There were
Purple Sage?
Yeah, he got... Riders of the Purple Sage, I still have that book.
Zane Grey's, yeah.
Yeah, and it was those little small hardbacks, you know, of Zane Grey. And
you said you got a set of, what'd you get, Shakespeare with the leather-bound books?
Yeah, which I have absolutely no... I mean, it was...
But you've kept them.
Yeah, most of them I have kept. Now, some of them Mama sold at a... Some of my mama sold at a yard sale, and I looked at her and I said, "Why in the world would you do that?" And she just didn't make the connection at the time, you know, to what they meant to me. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure I really did until I kind of started thinking about that book. I kept them, you know, right. I kept most of them, but they stayed in my mom's house. Some of them I dragged around with me, as I say in the book, I think, from city to city to city. Some got lost, some got left behind.
But, you know, it's the fact that it was something precious, and you knew, had right. to know that your dad went out and specially got right. that box of books
and see,
from
he,
somewhere.
He wouldn't have known that it was... I mean, Daddy was much better read than I ever gave him credit for. I would only find out how well read he was as a reader of purely for sport, purely to, like, read a great Western or read a... He'd read Tarzan books. He'd, you know, he'd read for fun, which is the way a lot of us would love to just read.
Right.
And, but I didn't know really know that as I wrote this book. But, you know, he probably bought them by the pound. You know, he probably bought them at a yard sale or bought them by the pound. And that's as good a way to buy books, I guess, as any other, I guess, by the pound.
Absolutely.
And, or by the box.
Well, Rick Bragg has been our very special guest today, and we are listening. You are listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. All Over But the Shoutin' is the book that Prudence chose for Greenwood Reads. If you have not read it, you must read it. You must get a copy of it because it just, it reminds us of our childhood and so many aspects of it, whether it's the exact story or something very similar. Now, do we have a couple minutes? Two? Three? Okay. Because I wanted to share something. This is from the Wall Street Journal. A 1950s world built to stir memory. They're using this in Alzheimer's care to stir the memories of those from the past. And I'm going to talk about it on the radio. But I thought when I was reading this book, I was like, wow, how cool is that? That we use the memories from the past. I mean, they are building communities right. based on the 1950s.
I heard about this, and it's staggering. You know, if you think, well, of course.
It's logical,
know?
Isn't it?
Right. I can remember everything that happened to me in 1967, I think. I cannot remember what I did last month. You know, I'm blank.
Jeff is like that with music. He can remember every word to every song from the 1950s, early 60s.
Right.
After that, he's just like, I don't know.
Well, there hadn't been any good music since.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, the last good music was, you know, 69. So, you know.
Yeah.
I'm truly a codger.
Yeah.
I'm a codger.
Codger. Oh,
yeah.
God, he's a codger. Well, listen, Rick Bragg, this has been an absolute delight to have you sit down and talk to us for an hour about some of your life, some of your books. If you don't know Rick Bragg, you need to know Rick Bragg. If you'd like to go tomorrow morning to the 10 o'clock slave-driven performance that it will be...
I'll be the one with the chains on his wrist.
Okay. You want to go to Ware Shoals tomorrow morning. Where is that, Prudence, at Ware Shoals?
It's on the high school campus, but it's a separate building. It's the Ware Shoals Community Library.
The Ware Shoals Community Library. And go there and listen to a guy that has a lot to talk about. And
admission is free.
and admission is absolutely free. So please go out and do that and go to your library and see if you can get one of these great books, All Over But the Shoutin'. Rick Bragg, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here today. Thank you.
No, this was easy and fun. We're on roller skates.
Yeah, we
went by in a hurry.
Thanks so much, Rick. Bye-bye, everybody.